Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Eunice and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Eunice.
Today we're going to be getting into Chapter 4 of A Gypsy's Kiss. And again, this book is available on Amazon if you would like your own copy. We just got a few more copies in, so we could read out of the latest and greatest.
Maybe when we get 2,000 subscribers, we can start giving them away.
2,000 subscribers. Mm. We have... Yeah. Let's do that. Sounds good. Yeah.
Were you going to fight with me on that one?
No, I was wait, how many our subscribers do we have? Okay, I had to think about it. How many we had. So we're going to get started with Chapter 4. Did you have anything?
What's the theme of this chapter?
What is the theme of this chapter? I think that after you listen to it, you'll be able to tell me.
Ugh, I'm terrible at that.
There is a lot of Spanish in this chapter. I'm going to do my best to read the Spanish. If I mispronounce things, Toby will say it again, and then he'll give you the English translation. It's because the character Manolo that we'll meet in this chapter is from Santa Fe, and he is a Hispanic person, and he has a lot of family members who would speak to him in Spanish. So he grew up speaking Spanish and English, but Spanish was probably his first language.
Spanish, for folks like this, was their primary language. And in addition to that, they spoke with an accent, what we used to call a Santa Feano accent, but he had one.
Yeah. Are you ready?
Yep.
All right. Chapter 4, The Gym. I work out in St. Mike's gym because it's lighted and open all night. The running track around the practice football field, on the other hand, has no lights, nor is it perfectly level, so there's a greater chance of tripping. At this time of the night, the only others in the gym are the janitorial staff, one of them currently sweeping across the gym floor with a wide cotton dust mop. I don't know his name, but he is Hispanic, a local, and we always wave at one another when I come in for my workout. I can run along the outside of the playing surface without getting in his way. I decide to run a football practice drill. That means I run facing in one direction around the outside of the playing surface, forward for one long side. Then, still facing forward, sidestep across the top. Then, backwards along the other long side, and finish the circuit by sidestepping across the bottom back to my starting point. I always faced the east end of the gym, and I run and sidestep and backstep and sidestep until I work up a sweat, breathing hard and getting as much of a workout as possible. After about 30 minutes on one of the sidestepping lengths, a bit of bad timing causes me to trip over myself and go down. I'm so tired, it feels easier to stay down than to get up. I stare at one of the auditorium lights overhead as my breath and heartbeat return to normal. My brain is in some kind of motion, but not organized enough to say what I'm thinking. A few seconds later, the janitor, sweeping in my direction, stops, looks down at me, and asks, "You okay there, bro?" He had that familiar Spanish accent of people who come from Santa Fe and speak English and Spanish equally well. I tell him, "Yeah, I'm okay," and stand up so he doesn't have to speak to someone lying down and sweating all over his clean floor. He has a sports towel over his left shoulder and tosses it to me so I can wipe myself down. "I see you work out here a lot," he gestures around the gym. "I do. It helps me to stay fit and to work out anything that's bothering me." "What could bother you, Ese? You have it muy suave here at La Escuela, no?" Did you want to say what that means in English?
So the English translation is, "What could bother you, buddy? You have it really good here at the school, no?"
He speaks in bilingual, the artful way of mixing English and Spanish in the same sentence.
So we call that bilingual.
Bilingual. It's just been a rough day. I messed up my English assignment. My girlfriend told me she invited someone else to the spring mixer, and my mother doesn't have time for me. That's it? That's all you've got? That's kind of it. But the part that bothers me the most is that I couldn't think of anything to say. I mean, I couldn't even form the words to tell them what I was feeling. Yeah, bro, I used to be like that, but my father helped me to fix it. Maybe you should talk to your dad. I can't talk to my dad. Why not? He's dead. Oh, lo siento, bro.
I'm sorry to hear that, brother.
So maybe I could tell you what my dad told me. He said, when you don't know the right words to say, borrow the words from someone else who's already said them just right. Like what? I ask. Like when my girlfriend told me she was going to break up with me, I said this verse to her. Roses are red, violets are blue. You're really cute, and I love you. We got married about 6 months later. Now, when she's mad at me for something, I tell her a poem or a quote or a short story, and she gets unmad at me. I'll have to remember to try that next time. I imagine how I might memorize some phrases or verses for future situations. It sounds to me like your father was a wise man. Él era muy inteligente.
He was very intelligent.
He traveled all over the world, and he had pictures from everywhere. He put them in books and put all the books on a shelf where we could see them. Every night, instead of telling us a bedtime story, me or my sisters would bring him one of his picture books and ask him to tell us those stories. He was a very good storyteller. That's what I want. To be a dad, he asks. No, I want to travel and see the world. My father and all my uncles on both sides of our family have amazing stories to tell about the things they've done in their lives. Even my mom moved to California to rivet airplanes during the war. Our family was always sharing stories of exciting accomplishments during our reunions and holiday gatherings. I want to live an exciting life and have stories to tell about amazing places, people, and adventures. But first, I need to have some. Let me give you some advice, little bro. Don't wait. I waited, and before I knew it, I had a wife, three beautiful daughters, many bills to pay, and a gym to clean every night. Don't wait. Remembering a favorite quote from my Uncle Mundi, I add, fortune favors the bold. You got it, bro. I reach out to shake his hand. He takes it in the classic grip of the New Mexican Brotherhood, and then he wraps his other hand around the outside of mine, grinning as we connect. All right, you're going to have to show what that looks like. Ah, that helps.
I lost my page.
That's why you got this thing. We're on page 33.
Okay.
At the very bottom.
Got it.
What's your name, I ask? Manolo. You? Mike. Mike? That's not a name that will get you any adventures. Necesitas un nuevo nombre. Te llamaré Miguel.
Te llamaré Miguel. You need a new name. I'm going to call you Miguel.
Okay. Te llamaré.
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 I'm going to call you.
Miguel.
Future.
Oh. Okay. There's romance in that name. An adventure. Miguel, he says, as if he is tasting the name. Miguel. Yes, I like it, I respond. Looking toward the ceiling in thought, he says, San Miguel is our patron.
Patron, yeah.
Patron. The avenging angel, un guerrero.
Guerrero, a warrior.
Miguel, the warrior, I say, trying to match his enthusiasm. Seguro que sí, little brother. Que te vaya bien.
Yeah, you're really good.
Doing my best.
Seguro que sí, of course, little brother. May things go well for you.
I march back to the dorm, ingesting my new persona and reciting lines from Thanatopsis. Go forth under the open sky and list to nature's teachings, while from all around, earth and her waters and the depths of air, comes a still voice. Can you hear it? That still voice is saying, don't wait, do it now. So I think the theme was in the last line there. Don't wait, do it now. What do you think?
Well, I would tend to agree because up until that time, Miguel or Mike is so focused on his own problems or the problems that he perceives to be, he's really not looking towards the future. And he doesn't have any sense that until Manolo reminds him that he's actually got it pretty good. He's got nothing to complain about, you know, short of girlfriends and bullies, and, you know, the stuff that everybody's going to have at some point in their lives. And I think this conversation with Manolo gave him the opportunity to realize, well, you know, adventure is in the heart, adventure is in the mind. And the start of an adventure is always that first step. And once you've taken that first step, you're looking forward, not back. And I think that's what's important about this conversation with Manolo, is that it gave some inner awareness to Miguel and some sensitivity for the potential of a future rather than focusing on the past.
Mm-hmm. And we introduced Manolo as one of the first mentors in this book.
It is. I mean, he doesn't. And that's how initial mentors in the hero's journey are. They don't stick around long. They're the ones that get you started. Mm-hmm. And then you may not see them again, or you may not see them until the return from the journey, where he gets to ask, how did it go?
Yeah.
Bro.
Yeah. So did you know people like this? Was this based on a real person?
It was based on at least one person, but there was a composite of all the people that mostly males that worked at the school. There were women who were Santa Feanos, Hispanic in background, that worked in the cafeteria, but almost everyone else in the school that was doing other than teaching was from Santa Fe, tended to be Hispanic, and they all had that same very relaxed attitude about life. They were comfortable, you know, whatever their future was there at the school, raising their families. You know, they didn't have visions of running off on their uncle's motorcycles. That whatever they had done, they had done. And so they were, I don't know that Manolo ever did anything other but, you know, get out of high school, probably Santa Fe High School, and not St. Mike's because it was expensive, and go to work for St. Mike's. I mean, that might have been his future, but he had a sense of adventure and how important it was to maintain some sort of internal vision of that kind of potential.
And so why is this chapter important to the story?
Well, again, we're following the trail of the hero's journey. And the hero's journey ends that first chapter with the first section. So the hero's journey, we should say, is divided into four segments. There's a three-part opening, a three-part first center, a three-part second center, and then a third-part closing. Now, those aren't the actual names, but that's how the story is divided. So the first part of that ends with the stimulation to change things for yourself. And generally speaking, with the hero's journey, it requires some sort of adventure. Now, that adventure may take place in your hometown. It doesn't mean you have to travel and go find things, but that's where the hero's journey really takes off, is probably the best way to describe it. There's the suffering of the hero and the lamenting of how terrible his life is. And then there's the thought, maybe I can do something else. And that's what this first mentor, as they're called in the hero's journey, instills in him. Now, he hasn't gotten quite past that. We're not at the end of the first chapter. The end of the first chapter is
act.
I'm sorry, you're right. Shelley knows that these things are divided into three acts, and that the second act is two separate. There's like an act two, part one, and act two, part two. So we're still in Act One, where he's starting to think about these things, but he hasn't taken any action yet. The end of Act One is the point at which the hero actually implements whatever his plan is to go off and seek his adventure. And like I said, it could have happened all in Santa Fe if he had wanted it to. He had bigger dreams and he had a plan. The moment he invokes that plan, the moment he takes the first step to implementing that plan, is the end of Act One and the beginning of Act Two, where the real adventures begin, where the real challenges begin, where the real excitement begins, you know, as much as a teenager on his own can have when it comes to excitement.
And I think we also are still setting up the world. So we're letting people know this is who lives in Santa Fe. These are the people that you're going to meet mm-hmm. in Santa Fe, especially in 64, but mm-hmm. even still today.
Even today, I think there is much more, the culture is more diverse in the sense that, so Santa Fe has always been perceived as a tricultural town. Mm-hmm. Native American, Anglo, and Hispanic. And back then, it was primarily like it was, I don't know, 60% Hispanic and then 20% Anglo and 20% Native American. Over the years, because of the artist community and the galleries and the kind of visitors that we get from all over the world with different expectations, I think it's changed so that it's probably 33, 33, 33. Right? The Native Americans, because of their art and their relationships with the various museums that represent their art. The Anglos, because of their businesses, mostly containing art, but other things as well. And their liking the idea of living in Santa Fe, which has become very, in its own way, cosmopolitan. But if you were to walk into any government office in Santa Fe, and Santa Fe is the capital, it is the roundhouse. If you were to walk into any office in Santa Fe or into the city, the offices of the city of Santa Fe, you would see primarily Hispanics there, a larger percentage of Hispanics, because that's what they do. That doesn't prevent them from having stores or working in the, you know, big box stores, things like that. Like every other small town in America, there are no mom and pop shops anymore. If they are mom and pop shops, it's based on whatever the culture demands at any given point in time. And for all intents and purposes, Santa Fe is an art town now. Galleries and artists and people who support galleries and artists or work in galleries and artists. But it's big enough to, you know, have everything from the Walmarts to the Home Depots to the, you know, restaurants, lots of hotels to support the inbound clientele. I've noticed that greater percentage of the housing is condominiums. So people are buying their condominiums to come back here. Santa Fe has mild summers and relatively mild winters. You know, it's not like living in Vail where you go specifically to ski, but the ski basin in Santa Fe is 13 miles outside of town. It's the drive is an easy one. The roads are kept constantly clear. And so it's got a lot going for it, and of course the expense with living in Santa Fe has gone up. I don't think there is any way, unless I were to make a certain number of sacrifices, like the size of my house, or even having to live in a condominium, I could afford to live in Santa Fe anymore.
Hmm. So, in a lot of people nowadays who are coming from a Hispanic background in living in New Mexico, don't speak Spanish because. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, the longer people are here, the more likely they are they just to only speak English.
So my mother speaks without an accent, right? Even though she came from Hispanic. The last person to speak Spanish to me all the time was my grandmother, who insisted that I speak Spanish. My mother and father weren't necessarily interested in us learning Spanish. They didn't feel there was any benefit to it and that it actually would keep us from speaking correct English without an accent or something like that. So theirs were the last generation to have been bilingual, because my mother was very comfortable with it and she could transition out of what I call cultural English to cultural Santa Feano, Like you could hear her accent come on when she wanted to. If she was speaking to someone on the phone, there was a lot of bilingual, and it was always with the accent. You could hear it in her voice. But when she spoke to us, when we had any kinds of conversations, when we were sitting at the dinner table, it was English, and it was unaccented English. And if we spoke with an accent, she would correct us. You know, she wouldn't let us get away with it. So she, they're with their last generation. My grandmother's generation was the last generation that spoke primarily Spanish. They were Delgados, Espinosas, Pereces. Even my father's father and his brothers and sisters, they all spoke Spanish as well as they did English.
So what do you think we gave excuse me. Mike?
Mike.
Why do you think we gave Mike the name Miguel in this chapter?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one, Mike truly is as unadventurous a name as anyone could manage. And at St. Michael's, I'm not going to say half, but 10% of the students were named Mike. I had five in my class, you know. Mm-hmm. My sweater, my letter jacket doesn't say Toby, it says Mike. Mm. And there were just a bunch of Mikes, and it wasn't even Michael. You know, Michael does have a nice sound to it. He is, after all, the patron saint of St. Michael's and things like that. But once you assign a name like Miguel, it almost sounds romantic, like you should be dressing in clothing that is worn by mariachi, you know, the tight pants and the silver buttons and things like that. That's what it had. And every time I would use that name, I fondly remember my Aunt Pauline, who was a Pennsylvanian Quaker, beautiful. And she married my Uncle Ernesto, who was the professor of industrial arts at Northern Colorado University. But she would come to visit during the summer months. And she would want to go see all the mariachi shows that were coming into the Santa Fe. Well, we had them in the high school. There was no convention center back then. She would want to go see them because she just loved all those mariachi and the way they dressed. And my family knew Uncle Mundi, of course, was sponsoring some of them, things like that. So they would come over to my grandmother's house and we'd have parties in the patio. And Aunt Pauline was just in dream world, you know, with all those mariachi around. But there was one, especially a trumpeter, whose name was Miguel. And she would ask if she came into town, is Miguel coming into town? Miguel, is he coming into town? Oh, I want to see him play. And it was just, and she was, I mean, she was a Quaker, for God's sakes, nothing was going to happen, but she just had the biggest crush on Miguel. So I think it was appropriate because I had kind of a high school crush on Aunt Pauline. So maybe that's why it works out.
So Miguel, he gets the name in this chapter and then mm-hmm. he continues to use it throughout the rest of the book. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you did as a young man?
I did on somewhere along the trip. I don't think it was this early. It was primarily the bikers because their names on their jackets, they were wearing their biker club jackets and their names on the jackets because they were New Mexican. They had Hispanic names. It was not Danny. It was Danielo or you know, and they had it. And I think that was the point at which Miguel felt like, I'm a New Mexican man, you know. I'm three quarters, at that time I thought I was, three quarters Spanish. Why not have a Spanish name? Mm-hmm. Even though I looked like a little white boy, I didn't have that. I do get brown, but I don't get that.
But not in February.
Yeah, not in February, not that New Mexican brown. Mm-hmm. The New Mexican brown is, you know, a different, deeper color. And so I thought it was appropriate. The minute I got back to school from the trip, I went back to being Mike, and I graduated Michael, and I didn't become a Toby until I joined the military, where they insist you use your first name. You don't have an option. You are Toby M. Eunice, and then your serial number, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was the only period in my life where I was adventurous enough to use it. Not that I didn't experience other adventures, as you well know, in my life, but I went back to school, and I was Mike again, until I joined the service, then I became Toby. And that's where I've been since then, the people that have known me ever since after college. I was still Mike in college. After college, I was Toby.
Would your family have called you Miguel? Like your mom, your brother?
You know what? The only time, it's not in our generation. When she'd get mad at me, she'd call me Tobias, which is the Spanish. Mm-hmm. And or if she got mad at my brother, she'd call him Vicente. Vicente, siéntate. And she'd talk to him in Spanish, right? But that's the only time I heard it use it. I don't think anybody ever used the name in a formal way, even to sign a term paper. We used Vincent, Edward, Rita Ann, Paul David, and Toby Michael. And the only time I got Tobias or Toby Michael was when somebody was mad at me.
You went to the gym because you had been having a bad day. Mm-hmm. And tell us about this workout and what it did for you.
So it does for me what my workouts still do for me today. It's my way of implementing a sense or a feeling of Zen, a calmness. The workout is designed, I don't think about anything except the workout. I don't use it as an opportunity to work out my issues other than whatever my weight is at any given point in time. But all I think about is the workout, and how much I love bike riding. And in bike riding, there's the wind and the fresh breeze and the avoiding traffic and making jumps when you can, things like that. But it's my way of releasing my brain of all the issues that my brain is attempting to focus on, and changing that focus to openness. It opens up your mind, and it gives you the opportunity to fill it with new, probably more interesting things. And that's what exercise has always been for me. I've never been an exercise for building bulk. That's never been my purpose, nor do I have the somatype that would allow that. I'm what's referred to as a mesomorph. I'm never going to have, big bulky muscles. That's just not my somatype. So I don't work out for that purpose. And as a matter of fact, when I do work out at a gym with weights, I get very bored with it real quickly. Like it seems like you have to focus on the numbers and the lifts and how much weight and things like that. And it doesn't give you. So the aerobic exercises for me are always more interesting, except for swimming. Just not swimming. Cycling and running were always my, and back then it was jogging. Nobody called it running. It was jogging. But cycling and jogging have always been my clean out my mind to give it the opportunity to absorb new thoughts and new possibilities.
And
it's still that way. Mm-hmm. I still don't work out to lose weight. I don't work out to, you get byproducts, of course, of aerobic capacity and losing weight. But for me, it's always clear my mind.
Okay. I wanted to, so Manolo is giving advice to Miguel about using other people's words and saying quotes or poems why did we put that in this chapter?
Because he's going to run into situations where people are going to expect him to respond in a certain way. And as Manolo advised him, we all struggle with creating our own words if we don't have time to do it. Now, over time, you do get to that point. You do get to the point that you've developed your own vocabulary and your knowledge base. Your own vocabulary and your knowledge base is widened enough so that should a situation arise, you can elicit words from your own contexts in order to respond to it. Up until that time, you have to borrow the words of others. And that's why you constantly hear people use poetry and prose from writers, authors, poets, politicians, other people. As Winston Churchill said, and then you quote Winston Churchill, as John F. Kennedy said, you use that as a way to stem the problem of you not being able to develop your own words. But with time and education and the confidence to use your own words, you get used to the idea that you always have a thought. And you, regardless of the situation, you always have the thought. And sometimes you can, you know, you can elicit that thought. You can express that thought in the context of somebody else's quote. But sometimes you can express that thought in your own words. And for the most part, it should make sense. Sometimes you'll say something, you know, as well as I do, that sometimes you'll call for one of those moments where you need to, you know, you need to say something of significance to respect the moment. And the simple fact of the matter is you come up with a line and it just doesn't work. I mean, you and I have both had those. I know I have. I know you have. And so you go like, ah, okay. Especially, I'm not especially good at times that require sympathy. I tend not to be good at that sympathetic part. So I have to either be quiet to avoid being stupid, looking foolish, or quote somebody. And a lot of the times I'll quote somebody.
So why did we continue to quote the Thanatopsis?
Well, because he's stuck with it, right? He had memorized Thanatopsis in that first chapter. He's up in front of the class reciting Thanatopsis from memory. Thanatopsis is what they call poetic prose. It's not poetry in the sense that there's rhyming. When William Cullen Bryan wrote it, Thanatopsis translates a Greek word, and it translates to a view of death. And that's what it's about. It's about passing from life into death. And I'm not even sure why I picked it, except that it was prose. And it's two book pages long, right? It starts up here and it ends down here. So it's quite, you know, you had to work at memorizing it. I was very proud of myself for having memorized it. And so and there's a lot of quotes in there. There are a lot of things in Thanatopsis that you could use to cite quote for a situation and cite Thanatopsis, or in this case, William Cullen Bryan. So it's stuck in his head right now. And then what's happening, of course, because it's stuck in his head, some event occurs and part of Thanatopsis pops into his head, you know?
And it could be kind of fun that there's tarot cards on the cover and the death card, which I don't know is the death card on one of them. Not sure.
I
think it might be the middle one. Anyway, the death card.
Oh yeah, it is the middle one.
Change.
Right.
There's going to be a change or a leaving behind of the childhood.
Right.
And moving into adulthood or young adulthood at least. So that is appropriate, I think. That you know that Thanatopsis. The theme is a view of death, and that death
is in the tarot. Death is representative of change. The last stanza, if you will, of Thanatopsis is so live, then when thy summons comes to join that innumerable caravan which moves to that mysterious realm, thou go not like a quarry slave at night, scourged to his dungeon, but sustained and soothed by an unfaltering trust. Approach thy grave like one who wraps the drapery of his couch about him, and lies down to pleasant dreams.
I cannot believe that you remember this from when you were 15, that you can still recite.
I can still recite
this poem because I can't do it. So why should you be able to do it? But yeah, it's always amazing to me that you still remember it.
Well, it's amazing to me that I can remember things from when I was 15 years old in high school, and I have a hard time remembering somebody making an appointment with me next week. So there's good news and there's bad news. So, but that's what having to memorize it for your English class instills in you. You'll never forget. I can still recite the Gettysburg Address for the same reason. Yeah. I had to memorize it in high school.
Now, if there's a song playing, might be able
you
to
get that.
Sing along
yeah.
with it.
Yeah, you can do that. Words. I can't do that.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's just a difference in our brains then.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to talk about as relates to act now to realize your dreams and don't wait?
So I am reminded of the situation in which you primarily find yourself in, with your husband suffering from a not only a debilitating case of cancer, but a life-ending case of cancer. And I am reminded that it all occurred within a year of his retirement.
Well, actually, he was forced to retire. He was going to retire when he was 62.
Right.
And he had to retire early because of this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And the same thing kind of happened to his dad. His dad, mm-hmm. right after he retired, months after he retired, he had a stroke. Mm-hmm. And was never the same. So it is kind of weird, you know, reminiscent of everything that his father went through. And also my grandmother, my grandmother had a very similar kind of cancer, mm-hmm. Of the lymph nodes, and it went throughout her body the way it's doing with him. So it's kind of like how you have names in your family that seem to keep popping up, mm-hmm. you know, Paul, for one, his dad's name was Paul. My son-in-law's middle name is Paul. Mm-hmm. You had a brother named Paul, mm-hmm. that keeps popping up, you know, in my life. There are certain things that continue to pop up. And, but for the last 2 years, the theme has been, you know, act now, mm-hmm. because life is short. Uh-huh. When my mom had a stroke last year, just before she turned 80, it was, you know, one thing and then another thing. And you know, I have two people who are, you know, the closest people I'm, you know, in my life. And they're both suffering these things that are doorway to death type of things. And it does hit home for me. And I know for you as well. Uh-huh. And probably for everybody in our family, you know, is aware that, you know, you've got to reach out and grab your dreams today because you don't know what tomorrow might bring.
Our tendency is to go through life with the expectation that life somehow for us is infinite. And at the same time, fate is throwing at us reminders that it isn't. And so every day we put off trying to reach one other dream is a day that we lose trying to reach our dreams. Now you get to the point that there are points in your life where you don't have a choice. You decided to have a family, you have to raise that family. But you can do things with your family that may not be the grand adventures that you imagined for yourself, but now you can have those adventures with your family members. I didn't sail in New Mexico. Sailing a boat was something that I learned when I was on the East Coast. And I learned to love it. And going out, you know, every summer for 2 weeks, traveling around the Chesapeake Bay was my way of experiencing that kind of adventure. And I have pictures, photographs with son Jason, daughter Sean, and the three girls. And they're if they're near a boat, they'll get on it. You know, that's something that they acquired just by hanging around with me. So part of my dreams are fulfilled when I see them fulfilling dreams from experiences they had with me, fulfilling miniature versions of my dreams. Now, at the same time, I was employed in a job that got me, that enabled me to see and do a lot of things that I would not otherwise had done. Had I returned to Santa Fe after college, opened a law firm, became a politician, done all those things, and never left Santa Fe. So I did, you know, that start that we see here was the beginning of Toby Yunus getting out of Santa Fe, going, not that Santa Fe was bad, but at that point it wasn't for him, going to places, including joining the military and experiencing the military to the fullest of my capability, and then coming back and, you know, living and working in Washington, D.C., and becoming a contractor and doing the travels that I did for them. So this was kind of the beginning of that life, as opposed to the beginning of the life of Toby Yunus, pre-law, law school, back to Santa Fe, law firm, lawyer with his own firm, maybe a judge, maybe a politician, et cetera, et cetera. It would have been a completely different life. This was, that didn't happen in my senior year of college. That happened right here.
Started there.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. The start happened right there.
Mm-hmm.
The decision to quit in the middle of my senior year and not go back to Santa Fe was just a continuation of all of that. Right. Taking mm-hmm. a chance, not finishing your college, making everybody you know mad, you know, for not finishing, and then joining the military during a time of war.
So when you think about your adventures throughout your life, is it something that you said, I'm going to do this A, and then I'm going to do B, and then I'm going to do C, and then I'm going to retire in Costa Rica? Or was it just things that happened, and then you're like, oh, let me try that again, or let me do more of that, or let me head in that direction?
I think I'll call it, the answer to that is probably the latter rather than the former. It wasn't planned in the sense that I would say, well, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that, and it'll give me the opportunity. You've heard the story of how I ended up going from the National Security Agency, which was my dream job, to an independent contractor, and going forward from that point. What I'm going to call it was the serendipity of Command Sergeant Major Williams. I've talked about him before, but he's the one who, when I asked how he became the youngest Command Sergeant Major in the Army, he said, I took every shit job that nobody else wanted. And that was my strategy for adventure, if you want to call it that. What made my life, to me, an interesting life to lead was when somebody said, we can't find anybody to do this, you want to do it, and saying yes. And that provided amazing opportunities, you know, things like 3 months in Russia and a half year in the Balkans and Iraq twice, Afghanistan, the South America, Central America, all of those were because nobody else wanted the job. And when they asked me, I said, sure. Now, was I putting myself at risk? To some extent, yeah. But the other thing that I always felt was like, it's just not my time, I guess. I know that's arrogant because you don't have a choice of when your time is. So as I'm getting, and as I get older, I realize that more and more, you know. But yeah, I would say it the components of my life that made my life interesting to me, because I don't think anybody else would think of it as interesting. You know, my family didn't think, oh, this guy has a really cool, you know, cool job, you know. I think the things that made my life interesting to me was the result of A, the serendipity of getting the offer, and B, the command sergeant major decision to say to yourself, that's a really shitty job. Yeah, I'll do it. So.
I'm sitting here trying to think, what adventures did I want to have in my life? And I can't really think of anything, but I think that you probably will agree that becoming a parent is an mm-hmm. adventure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because you grow so much, you learn so much. Your world expands, and you have this whole new experience that just makes you into a different person. You're a father now, you're a mother now. You've become a new person. And then none of the jobs I've had have been really life-changing, but they've taught me a lot. I wouldn't say that they were adventurous. You know, I worked for an airline. I worked as a preschool teacher. They were, you know, I had a nice variety, but it wasn't like taking me on big trips or anything. But I did learn a lot.
I know you've told me about trips that you and Kevin have taken, including train trips through Europe and things like that. So mm-hmm. you did get the opportunity to explore some of that.
Yeah, but that was more of a, I don't know, just seeing the world, but not really I don't know. I guess I think of it more as just a vacation and it's just for fun. Mm-hmm. Whereas you are doing like expanding your world that much more.
So I would say it's the combination, the difference is the combination of opportunity, because I was in a place where I was getting those opportunities. I mean, I remember I was in Washington, D.C. I had a top secret clearance and I was getting contract offers that fit with what I was doing, you know. That's the first thing. So opportunity and either, I don't think it was gross courage as much as it was like, I don't want to say it's somewhere between gross courage and gross stupidity. I'm not the most courageous guy in the world, but I'm also not the most stupid guy in the world. So when somebody says, we've got this job for you, we've got this contract that nobody else wants, do you want it? It wasn't either stupidity or gross stupidity or gross courage that would cause me to say yes. What caused me to say yes was confidence. Like, yeah, I can do that, you know? And I think that the opportunity plus the confidence to say yes to the opportunity has always kind of driven my life in its total, not just during that period that I thought was pretty adventurous, but it's always been that way for me. Opportunity and just the confidence to say, yeah, I can do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this week's newsletter, we talked a little bit about just go for your dreams and make sure that you're taking the time to, you know, get an overview of where you're at and where you want to be. And to me, I'm just like, I don't know where I want to be. I just want to get to the other side of what I'm going through right now.
Yeah.
But I don't have a dream per se that I want to, you know, go do this adventure of some kind. It's,
Well, I think it's kind of the expectation of the definition of adventure. You know, when we define adventure, we talk motorcycles and traveling on the highway for, you know, 1,200 miles. You're experiencing an adventure that is likely once in a lifetime adventure. You're experiencing the passing while you still live of your husband with a terrible disease. So the short-term dream, there's nothing quite like having a short-term dream that says my job in order to make myself complete, my adventure is to get through this without completely falling apart. And you have people on your side that are helping you get through it. But if you can get through this one, come out the other side with a solid perspective on life that enables you to imagine what your next adventure is. Just get through this one. You know, this is the one where somebody walked up to you and said, we've got a job that nobody else wants. You want it. And you say, what is it? And you say, well, your spouse is going to pass away from a terrible case of cancer. You want that one?
No,
nobody wants that one, but you'd say, well, yeah, I guess. What can I get out of it?
Yeah.
The learning, the exploration of emotions that you have never felt before and may never felt again, never feel again. So it's all of those that make it the kind of adventure. And maybe that's too blasé a word to be using for it, but it's an adventure in the sense that you've never experienced this before. You almost didn't have a choice. You, from what I can tell, are saying, okay, well, let me take this on. You're agreeing to take this on. And you can look past it and you can start thinking about what goes on from that point and you start a new one at that point. So I think you're very fortunate to have the people around you that support you and can help you get through it. None of us, A, ever expects that it's going to happen to us. And none of us cares for us to happen to us. We would prefer that didn't happen to us. You know, but it is happening and it is your, nobody else wants this job. You want it?
Now you're getting into acceptance over, we're talking adventure.
Well, it's an adventure because it's something that you haven't experienced prior to this time. Right. And you're going to learn. You're already learning. You know more about finance. You know more about, you know, what you do when someone does pass and what happens and the memorials and, you know, burials.
Metal recycling.
Yeah, metal recycling. Right, you did such a good job yesterday. You made money taking all that metal to be recycled, you know. So that was a new adventure. Look at all the new things you're learning.
That's true.
So.
That's true. Learning. Today I learned about how to donate your body to science.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
So.
So your financial advisor was in town last week. He's a really good guy. And you asked him a series of questions. And I would assume, not having heard from you before this, always allowing Kevin to take care of it. Now you know more about that situation than
I paid bills today.
You did? Yeah. I did. See? Yeah. I get that adventure twice a month.
Yeah. Big adventure. I have paid bills in the past, but not for a really long time because it always depressed me to look at numbers like that. And I don't want to look at numbers and I don't want to spend money. And I didn't want to pay the bills, but now I don't have a choice.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny because I take bill paying very seriously. Now, I've done it most of my life. You know, you're just the nature of that beast. But I have a very good I sit down at night. I have a spreadsheet. I open up the spreadsheet. I have a printing calculator over there. I have a notebook in which every one of those, if my kids ever find out need to know what my bills were, it's all in here on the 1st and 15th of every month. And so I have a process that's very satisfying. I like getting to the end of the process, adding up all the bills on there, looking what I have in terms of disposable income, and then breaking down the disposable income into food, gas, clothes, you know, all that other stuff, and playing and toys. So I actually look forward to it. I look forward to when I know the amount of, you know, the two monthly checks that I get from the proceeds go into my account, and my account lets me know, and I get to sit down and pay bills.
Wow. Now we know anything can be an adventure if you just look at it that way.
Yeah, I think everything that you can turn into an opportunity to learn more about life and more about yourself, not having done it before, is an adventure. And that makes it real easy to call the things that we experience in our daily lives, a lot of which we haven't had to experience in the past. I have the benefit of being 74 years old, so I've had a lot of stuff happen. It's not as my life isn't as adventurous as it used to be. But I think if somebody were to call tomorrow and say, we're making a documentary on the rising oceans and we'd like you to direct photography, you know, we're going to pay you this, and you get a car to travel to all the coasts. I would go for that in a minute.
Another adventure.
Yeah, another adventure.
All right. Well, I hope that you all enjoyed listening to today's adventure, and you have an adventure in mind for yourself as well.
So look at what's coming up in your life, and if there's a chance that it's going to improve you personally or improve the situation in which you find yourself, it's going to make you a better person or put you in a better place, then call it an adventure and go for it.
I think that's all we have for today. So once again, if you have a story about going for a dream, living through an adventure, write to us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And make sure you sign up for weekly updates at news.agkmedia.studio. And we'll get our weekly newsletter that gives you all the latest and greatest updates for AGK Media. That's us. We are AGK Media Studio, Shelley and Toby.
Let's say goodbye.
That's all I've got for today. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story, because your story matters.